This is Fred Rivara and Dimitri Christakis for JAMA Pediatrics. Welcome to this podcast today. You can look at these and other podcasts on our website at www.jamapeds.com. So we have two interesting articles today, and Dimitri will talk about the first one.
Hi, so I'm going to talk about this paper called Effectiveness of a Multi-Component Sun Protection Program for Young Children. It's actually a randomized controlled trial done in two pediatric clinics, and the intention was to see if we could get parents to protect their children from the sun. So we all know the importance of using sunscreen and practicing sun avoidance. We also know that most people, including many of ourselves, don't do it. I was recently diagnosed with pre-basal cell cancer on my face from many years of sun exposure in Greece.
Well, I grew up in New York City, went to the beach every summer, and I had cataract surgery by age 50.
There you go. In fact, we used to practice techniques to help us get darker. But anyway, that was a different era. So they had 300 kids, and they did kind of interesting study. So as you know, it's impossible to blind behavioral studies, and that's one of the neat things about this. So in the intervention group, the intervention was basically that they gave the kid, the parent, a sun shirt, a sun protective shirt. They gave them a 13-page book about the importance of sunscreening, a read-along book. And then they texted them four weekly sun protection reminders once a week, and they followed them up at 4 to 6 weeks. And this was done in the summer, and the outcomes were basically self-reported behavior change of the parents, the sort of standard kind of weak outcome in a behavioral intervention. But then they did something that I thought was really cool. They actually looked by spectrophotometry at the children in each group to see how much melanin there was and had there been a difference between the two.
I agree. I thought that was great.
Because when I was first reading it, I thought, you know, self-reported behavior change in a non-blinded intervention, you know, and I couldn't even imagine there was a gold standard. So I'll cut to the chase because the self-reported behavior change was in the direction you would think. But they did see significant differences with what I take as an objective, scientific measure of sun exposure. So it does work, which I thought is really great. Now, what's the problem with the study? Well, I think, you know, as always with these things, the real question is, how is this disseminated and implemented on a regular basis? So what I didn't like about it was, you know, they're giveaways. The text messages are fine and cheap and could be automated, but, you know, they're still giving away a shirt, marginal cost, not very expensive, and a booklet, which also isn't very expensive. So it's not that it's an expensive intervention. I don't even doubt that it's cost effective. The real question is, who's now going to pay to do this? How do we get this to be continued?
Well, I like the study because I do think it showed an effect. And it seems to me the most important part of this study was actually the shirt. The booklet didn't seem to really change behavior that much. Same number of kids got sunburned, but it looked like the shirt really was protective. So how do you get kids to use the shirt? I think a few things. One is that we all know our hospitals want to do marketing. Why don't they make these shirts for kids and have their hospital logo on them? I mean, parents would probably use those things. Number two is that they're probably not that expensive.
No, they're not. They're not that expensive, certainly.
And I think if you made them available to parents and pushed them in such a way that parents understood their importance, I think parents would actually buy these things. One of the questions I have to you, since you're a media guy, is what do you think about this whole idea of using text message reminders to change parent behavior?
Well, you know, it's de rigueur now, and I guess the only question I have, the only concern I have about it is, you know, does it go the way of pop-up reminders on in electronic medical records? Because there's only so many texts you're going to want to get before you start to feel like it's spam and you start tuning out. So I do think, you know, we have text for vaccines, we have text for baby, we have now text for sunburn. How soon before we get text fatigue?
But, you know, I mean, the average probably 25-year-old parent probably gets 50 texts a day from friends and family. So if they get one text a day from their pediatrician, they might actually pay attention to it.
If it's consolidated with specific messages.
Yes, you can't send 10 texts.
Yeah.
But if you get one text, you know, every few days or something, it might be actually worthwhile.
Hey, and there's one other thing I forgot to say that was interesting about this, which is the demography. So at first read, and I should have brought this up before, the median age of parents was 36 years, and they were fairly well educated and well off SES, and the majority of them actually were white kids. So again, at first blush, I thought, well, wait a minute. what's the external validity of this? But of course, then I realized that actually it works out perfectly because the kids that are at higher risk actually for sun effects are actually children of non-color. So this is one of those rare occasions where disparities work the other way around.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was really a very nice study. And I think, again, that including that objective measure of outcome was really very important.
So those of you who are out there listening, you pediatricians, try to get your hospitals, as Fred said, to provide the sun shirts.
And here in Seattle, since we never had sun, it always rains, we don't have to worry about this. The next study is on fish intake in pregnancy and child growth. And this is a very nice, very large study from a group of European, primarily European investigators. And it's looking at the consumption of omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids. Now, we all know that these omega-3s are good, but there have been some indications that if mothers eat a lot of fish that has omega-3s in them, that it potentially could be harmful. And one of the things we know is that the FDA has actually recommended that pregnant women eat no more than 3 helpings of fish a week. And the reason is that fish that we have here available in the United States, and frankly probably in most parts of the world, is contaminated with mercury. And if you eat much more of fish than the 3 times a week, you potentially could have your baby exposed to toxic amounts of mercury. But there are some other small studies that showed that increased intake of omega-3s was also associated with increase in birth weight. So the purpose of this study was to really look at this latter issue, is consumption of omega-3s during pregnancy associated with overweight and obesity in the children from those pregnancies in the first 4 to 6 years of life. And what these folks did, they actually gathered 15 different cohorts that had collected this information, not necessarily for this purpose, but they collected this information as part of these longitudinal cohort studies. And they looked at the intake of fish during pregnancy and divided up into those less than once a week, 1 to 3 times a week, and more than 3 times a week. And then they looked at the weight of these kids at age 4 and 6, as well as the amount of weight gain that they had during the first 3 years of life. And what they showed is, first of all, that there was pretty tremendous variation in the fish intake from once every 2 weeks in Belgium to over 4 times a week in Spain. And secondly, is that this issue of obesity is certainly not just a U.S. problem. They found that overall in the cohort, there was a 15% incidence of overweight or obesity, and it varied from about 10% in the Netherlands up to 56% in Greece. And then it's at 4 years of age, and then at 6 years of age, the highest was in Portugal. And what most importantly is that they found that women who ate fish more than 3 times a week during a pregnancy gave birth to offspring with had higher BMIs at 2 years, 4 years, and 6 years of age, and that there was greater gain of weight during the first year of life. So in other words, that their hypothesis that increased consumption of omega-3 fatty acids was actually associated with increased risk of overweight and obesity, that hypothesis was upheld. And they talk a little bit about what might be the mechanisms of this. And it's interesting is that they talk about 2 different mechanisms here. One is that the omega-3s somehow might program your fetal cells in such a way that leads to later obesity. But the other thing is that fish consumption is also associated not only with the risk of ingesting mercury, but also with the risk of ingesting endocrine disrupting chemicals like phthalates. And phthalates have been associated with increased risk of obesity. So, you know, there's 2 potential mechanisms here of how this increased fish consumption could result in increased later obesity. So it's one of those things where a little bit is good for you, but too much is bad.
Right. Well, you did neglect one of the most important findings of the study or points of the study, which is the corresponding author is actually on faculty at Crete, the University of Crete. So this is for us a major coup. I thought it was an interesting study and obviously very, very large, very comprehensive. And to be honest, it's nice when there are 2 reasons to recommend limiting fish intake rather than just 1. I have to admit, I was not expecting this to be the case because we tend to think of fish as being an incredibly healthy food. And I'm also curious because, you know, there are populations for which fish is truly subsistence part of their diet. This is by no means my area of expertise, but I know, for example, up in, you know, the Inuit and people who live But then I thought, you know, it may be that obesity in those situations, in those cultures, is not actually harmful. It maybe it's somehow it's protective. And so there is some evolutionary reason why fish consumption prompts obesity in situations where it's beneficial.
You know, the other thing here is that the effect sizes are what you might expect. I mean, their odds ratios are 1.14, 1.22. So it's not huge, but they're certainly significant. And they had a large sample size to actually look at this. Do you think this is going to have any impact upon what pregnant women do?
It's interesting because I think for many women, it's not going to represent a large change in the recommendation. Where did the U.S. fall on this in terms of fish consumption? I seem to recall it was in Europe that was all the big action.
Europe was the real action there.
Yeah. I think most of the consumption here is fish sticks, which is not, you know, particularly – I don't even know that it has fish in it. I don't know. It's interesting. And we've seen the crisis that Zika has wrought on pregnant women now. So will this be treated that way, or will it be treated as something not to worry about?
Yeah. And, you know, I think that their figures actually show some very nice spread, that most women have a moderate amount of fish intake, but there are certainly women there that have very, very frequent fish intake where this might really represent an important problem. Well, thank you for listening to this podcast. Please go to our website and listen to this and other podcasts at www.jamapedes.com. Thank you.